No one has ever taken ancient DNA, put it in a living species, and also done it through multiplex editing and got 100% efficiency.
I view it as like forced evolution.
I love that idea.
You're forcing the gray wolf to become a dire wolf through like little tweaks in the DNA.
We're now making over 50 edits at once right now, which is insane.
How do you think through the PR side versus the practicality side?
Mammoths are closer related to Asian elephants than Asian elephants are to African elephants. Always blows people's minds.
Ben, thanks for doing this.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So for people that don't know, can you give just a quick primer on what Colossal is?
Yeah, so Colossal is the world's first de-extinction and species preservation company. We use a lot of genetic engineering, computational biology, to solve some pretty hard challenges in genotype to phenotype relationships, and we open source all the technology for conservation.
And you've been at it for how long?
Since 2021, so nearly 4 years.
And raised?
We raised $435 million for the company. And then we have a foundation where we raised $50 million.
And so as you thought about this, we'll get into the background and how all this stuff came to be, but...
Complete accident too.
Yeah. Well, so maybe give that short version of like how you sort of fell into this.
So I'm a software guy and I've only known how to build like teams of software. I try to hire much smarter women and men than me. And I've always just thought about like the system, right? You know, you've been in software, right? You invest in software. So it's all just system design, right? So I think that really good software engineers and really good system designers can really just figure out how to ask the right questions. Like, I don't have to be an expert in biology. I just know how to kind of ask the right questions and hire people that can answer them at least better than I can, right? And so I thought that, you know, looking at kind of access to compute, AI, and synthetic biology, this idea that we can engineer life, that we can do directed evolution, that we can do accelerated evolution, was going to be really interesting. And then if you layer on quantum, which I hear is only 2 years away every 2 years, that's going to be really crazy. And I think we're going to enter this whole new world. So I reached out to George Church, who's the father of synthetic biology. He's head of genetics at Harvard. Some of the core read-write technologies that exist in the world were all invented by him in his lab, as well as David Liu up at Harvard. So I thought I'd reach out to him halfway into the conversation. I was like, what else are you working on? Because I'm weird and curious. And he started going down this path of like all these different projects that he's working on. And it was a little overwhelming. And then I asked, you know, the probably the most interesting question of my life, which is, if you had unlimited capital, what would you work on and why? And it was the mammoth. He's like, I'd work to bring back extinct species, make technologies for human healthcare, make technologies for eventually for conservation.
It was the mammoth just like... forgive the guess colloquialism, but a pet project of his, or was there some like derivative consideration of?
No, well, he thought that we had like the amalgamation of all the tech, right? It's also majorly not efficient right now. So you need to innovate on all this stuff, but there wasn't any major like science gaps, right? We could get ancient DNA, we could do comparative genomics, you could build sequencing, you could make edits, even if you only want to make one edit at a time, and then you could figure out kind of the embryology. So there's some things to figure out on the gestational side, but for the most part, like we had all the core tech. Hmm. And so his vision was, at the time, he raised $100,000 for his lab from Peter Thiel, who just gave him a donation, and he was stretching that out over the course of 10 years. So he wasn't very far.
And so,
it turns out it's a lot more expensive.
Yeah, I can imagine. Well, I guess to that end, like as you set out to go do this, did you have some business that it could ultimately be? Because when you talk about this and you start to unpack it, it sounds almost like a research project in a lot of ways.
Yeah, but like a lot of academic research projects, they result in papers and not products. Not that there's anything wrong with papers. I get a lot of feedback on my views of papers, right? But at the end of the day, you can't ship a paper to anyone except the scientific community. And so I felt like there's got to be a way. Our first pitch deck was pretty shitty. It was, you know, George thinks he can bring back a mammoth. We are pretty confident we know how to build teams. We're pretty sure there's value there, right? Like that literally was the first pitch deck. So I guess the short answer in the beginning was no. Over time, we realized that, you know, to really make this work at the speed we want it to work, the impact we wanted to work, and the scale we wanted to work, we had to innovate on a lot of technologies. There's a little bit we had to invent, but for the most part, we had to innovate. And all those created, you know, massive opportunities for both human healthcare and to some industrial use cases. So we thought that like kind of that Apollo-esque model to start would be interesting. Over time, there's been other business models that have arisen that we think are even equally interesting.
I want to dive into the process and all of that stuff as well. But so recently you announced the de-extinction of dire wolves.
Yeah, dire wolves.
And you have three?
So we have three. Yeah, so we've got two males and one female.
Yeah. Maybe we can dive into, yeah, like the actual process of how to actually
also the shirt is awesome.
Yeah, it's sick.
Yeah, we do. We make all of our own stuff, and we work with a lot of top designers, and we don't sell it. We just give it to our team. And so when you come to the lab, you guys should come see check out the lab, because the lab's way cooler than talking to me. And it's like a hodgepodge of all these people wearing cool Colossal shirt. So we'll send you one.
That's awesome. Yeah. I was going to mug you afterwards for the shirt. So I'm glad you
got it. Yeah, I don't have an undershirt, so please don't. Travesty to the world.
I thought just, you know, as a non-scientist in science as well.
Yeah, same. Yeah, you done well in as a non-scientist in science.
Yeah, so I pretend I understand, but I just kind of memorize the phrases. But
I feel like I'm going to do that for every species. Like, I had to learn a lot about elephants. And it's like the ultimate, like, college cram, right? Where it's like, okay, I've learned everything about marsupial gestation. I have to learn everything about this. So it's cool because you actually get to learn a lot.
Yeah, I find the same. It's like, okay, I'm going to go learn about like biologics today and try and remember the words.
It's its own nomenclature. It's so weird.
So maybe to try and keep it like somewhat high level, but in the science.
Yeah.
When I think about this step by step and curious to learn like how you do this, we will start with a direwolf.
Yeah.
So you've got old direwolf DNA,
right?
Let's say. So we kind of know the underlying DNA of the
which direwolf. Is hard in itself.
To find it.
Yeah. No, yeah. To find it. So like in like La Brea tar pits, they have thousands of direwolf skulls, but they've all been stressed due to heat and acidification. So there's no DNA, at least no recoverable DNA.
No recoverable DNA.
So there's kind of this like, before it all starts, there's like this search. Like you've got to have something to start. And we found that you need about 6x coverage to be able to do this. So that means that you have to have, you probably know this, but for everyone else, is like you need to be able to read the full genome about 6 times. You need to get enough destructive sampling that you can get about 6 passes of the full genome to get enough of the core regions to assemble it.
Yeah. So let's say, and we can simplify, you know, this is what we're aiming for, if you will. So you've got kind of like that DNA. And then on the other side of it, you've got an existing live species.
Yes.
That is close enough.
Close enough.
But not the same.
Not the same.
So walk us through, how do you determine where in the DNA the differences that matter lie, right? Because there's lots of differences.
Lots of differences. Yeah. So yeah, that point, like people sometimes get confused and they're like, well, an Asian elephant's 99.6% a mammoth, but they're like, but that 0.4 is quite large, as you know. What's interesting though about certain species, like mammoths are closer related to Asian elephants than Asian elephants are to African elephants. It always blows people's mind, right? And so we look for the closest living relatives, because I think if you think about it, both from a reproductive tract perspective and from an evolutionary biology perspective, they will have the highest likelihood of less number of impactful edits. And so what we try to do is very much like software. So I think it's nice to talk to someone about this in software. We think of this as like functional de-extinction. We're not trying, we've always said this, we are not trying to clone an extinct species. There's no living cells for direwolves or mammoths or anything, regardless of what like weird TikTok someone occasionally sees about like there's like living
Jurassic Park.
Yeah, there's dinosaur cells. I see that, and then like I get a flurry of like people sending me DMs or like they found dinosaur cells. Like they did not find dinosaur cells, or the dinosaur embryo you got probably seen on Instagram. It's like that's fossilized. It's not real. It's real. It's not viable. And so what you do is you look for the closest living relative, and then we're really looking for the genes that are fixed and conserved across it. Now, if you can get multiple samples, so on the mammoth, we have about 65 mammoth genomes, right? Ranging from about 1.2 million years old to about 4,000 years old, which is great because then we can really identify what truly made a mammoth a mammoth. Because as you know, a lot of that's like genetic diversity, genetic drift and whatnot. But what are the core things that drive core phenotypes? And so we think of ourselves as more of an engineering company. The more computational biology we can do, the smarter we can be about the edits, the lettuce edits we can make with the highest impacts. You know, if you can write something, you write software 3,000 lines of code, and you write software that's 6 lines of code, you want the second one every day of the week for efficiency, for bug detection, for all of these things. We think of it the same way. And so we spend a lot of time trying to identify what genes are fixed and what are in the regions that we already know from literature that drive like size, hair phenotypes, coloration, and whatnot. And, you know, like on the mammoth, it's about 85 genes. So there's about 85, it's still a lot, but it's not like you don't have to make, you know, 2 million changes to get the core phenotypes that really made a mammoth a mammoth.
All right, before we go into like the specifics on making the two things work together, but so did you start top down, like, hey, we want to make a woolly mammoth and a dire wolf, and then figure out the ways to do it? Or did you have like 15 different things and what's viable that we could actually do?
So we started with the system, right? We're like, we started with the mammoth, and then we said, how do you make a mammoth, right? So we've kind of like built out like that core system. It has ancient DNA extraction, it has DNA assembly, it has comparative genomics, it's got tissue culture, it's got cellular engineering, genetic engineering, embryology, somatic cellular cloning, effectively. Yep. It's got all embryology, like IVF and elephants. So we had to go figure out the whole system.
And where'd you actually find the DNA of the mammoths?
So we actually worked with, twofold. One is I'm on the board of trustees of the Explorers Club. And so they actually have people that go out into the Arctic and have expeditions. George Church has actually been to Siberia and Church Key and all these and brought back samples. Most of our samples actually come from University of Stockholm. So we work with Luva Dahlin, who's the number one mammoth researcher in the world. And he actually provides us with DNA and samples, right?
And so, is it preserved in a way that's actually replicable?
So it depends, right? So it comes in all shapes and sizes. So, you know, what's great about, you know, mammoths is a lot of them died in cold places. So it was preserved on some level. But most of it comes not from that fleshy tissue. People think that that's it, or mummification. Most of it comes from like teeth and the petrous bone, which is like an inner ear bone that's really, really like condensed, and it doesn't change a lot after you're born. So it's a great DNA storage vessel. It's amber is not the best DNA storage vessel, if you've seen a movie about it.
Yeah, and I think this nuance, especially like when I've talked about this idea with people, because I had it's, you know, it's cool.
Yeah.
That maybe people miss in the beginning is you're not actually trying to take the mammoth DNA or the direwolf DNA
and ram it into
and just like stick it into and grow it and that's actually I think what everybody thinks at first.
They're
because it's Jurassic Park. You're like, I'll just grow the dinosaur, and that's not how it works. But what you're actually trying to do is take the closest living relative to a direwolf. In this case, what's the name of the species?
Oh, it's for a direwolf. It's a gray wolf.
A gray wolf. Yeah. Gray wolf. That's what I was missing. And you're saying, all right, if I make a few changes in the gray wolf DNA, I'm gonna get things that look like direwolves, maybe not an exact copy, but inching closer to
it. And they are the, and like, so if you were to take the, if you were to take like, for example, elk coral, it's a gene that drives size. If you take elk coral from the direwolf and elk coral from a gray wolf, and you were to take them out, right, to this Jurassic Park example, and then stick them back in, what we've done is we take out in this case, we synthesize elk coral with the same code. Because what people don't realize is like, or what some people don't realize is that the DNA, those cells are dead. So we're basically getting the code, right? We're getting what are the right letters in the right order.
It's code, but not actually viable DNA.
It's not actual viable DNA. It's not like we're taking blood out and injecting blood. We're reading the code, and then we're either changing what's in there or synthesizing a piece and swapping it in. So if you had blinders on and you then cut that exact gene out, it is the direwolf gene. It's just been synthesized, right? Because you can't move it over there. Sometimes people think we've got like the smallest like scissors and the smallest like little tweezers and we move shit. And that's just not the case.
And this is maybe a stupid like definitional thing, but when you announced this, there were so many people that were parsing like the language kind of to what Zach is saying.
Semantics.
Like, you didn't bring them back from extinction. And so I guess, how did you think about what the appropriate end state was to get to?
It's a great question. So we've said from day one, in fairness to semantic arguments, is that like, we've been very transparent and clear with what we're doing from day one. Like we say, we made this many edits. These are the edits we made. These are what they do. They're like, we didn't say, hey, we made a mammoth. We promise it's a secret, and we don't like we said all of that. Like when we made our woolly mouse, we're like, here's every edit we made in every single region, and here's about like we've been very clear about it, right? So make no mistake on that. But what's been interesting is we've also talked about functional de-extinction. We've said we cannot clone mammoths. We cannot clone these species. These cells don't exist. We've been very, very clear about it, right? But you know, there's a group called the IUCN, which is like the it's in the Species Survival Commission, which is like the UN of species. And they came out 5 years before we started the business and said, here are the things that you have to do in order to make an extinct species, right? To be classified as extinct species. And what other people don't know is there's actually like 31 different ways. I didn't know this because I'm not a biologist or a paleontologist. There's 31 ways, kind of like Baskin-Robbins, of like how you define a species, right? So we were probably taught, or I was taught in my schools, that the biological species concept, where it's like if things can't interbreed, then they're unique species. But if you see a polar bear and a brown bear, guess what? They're unique species. They have a different species, same genus, but separate species names. Most wolves and canids fall in that same category, as well as most bears. But by like the biological definition of species, which is one of the 31, they're not the same. They should be classified as the same species. If you ask most paleontologists, they will agree that they should be not separate species. You know, morphologically, one's white, one's Arctic adapted, and one's aquatic. But they have babies that are super healthy all the time. There's tons of interbreeding that happens there. And I think that what people don't always realize is that speciation is a human construct that we're trying to put on these things, right? And so for us, you know, we've been very clear that we're doing functional de-extinction. We've been very clear you can't clone an extinct species. We've always said that we're trying to identify the core genes that make a species and bring those back, right? To make proxies for that. So we've been super clear on that. And what's been the two things that one's sad, one's funny. What's been sad about some of the reaction of the direwolf is that, yes, while it broke the internet, the people that spent hundreds of hours, like Time Magazine and The New Yorker and Rolling Stone, that spent hundreds of hours with our teams, went to our labs, talked to external validators, talked to us, their conclusion was, yeah, this is as direwolf as we're ever going to get, right? Because to your point, 99.5% was the same. So they came to that conclusion, right? Like, we didn't write those headlines. You know, there will always be people that debate semantics, but the sad thing is they kind of miss the bigger picture here, right? Like that, you know, we're inspiring kids, we're bringing technology to conservation, and we've done genetic feats that no one else has done. No one has ever taken ancient DNA, put it in a living species, and also done it through multiplex editing and got 100% efficiency. I mean, you know, from your background, like that's insane. And so they've kind of like the Seinfeld, they're like yada, yada, yada over the science, and they just want to argue the name. And it's like, if the worst thing that happens in our direwolf is that people want to argue the semantics of how to classify it, then I think we've done okay.
I think I view it as like forced evolution is the method you're using.
I love that idea, yeah.
Right? Because you're not kind of like, I mean, you're working backwards in the logic, but the actual way the science happens is you're forcing the gray wolf to become a direwolf through like little tweaks in the DNA.
Yeah.
And that's how you get there. By the way, that's probably how the direwolf evolved in the first place.
So three things on that. I love forced evolution. It's a great way. I always say accelerate. That is forced evolution. But what's interesting is that people don't realize this, but we have a 13,000-year-old tooth, and we have a 63,000-year-old or 62,000 or 72,000-year-old skull. So we have 60,000 years of genetic divergence. There's more genetic divergence between our two direwolf samples than the living wolf cells and our tooth. People forget that part, right? So from an evolutionary distance perspective, there's actually more evolutionary distance between our two direwolf samples than our direwolf and gray wolf sample, right? And so people kind of forget that. And then the other thing is I love to ask people like, did you see Jurassic? Because we get the, believe it or not, we get the Jurassic Park question occasionally.
I can imagine.
And that's
actually page two.
It's all page
with two. Photos
and
as well.
We always get the question, and I always ask people, like, well, did you watch Jurassic Park? And they're like, yeah. I was like, what's the movie about? Some people get cute, and they're like, about human hubris. But what is the movie really about?
Dinosaurs.
It's about fucking dinosaurs, right? And so in that, I'm like, well, are they? Because they're genetically modified birds with ancient DNA and with frog DNA, and then the latest one, they've got everything under the sun in it, right? And so they are synthetic biology, genetically modified organisms. So are they dinosaurs, or are they that? So it's like, if you classify what you see in Jurassic Park as dinosaurs, going by Jurassic Park tech, right, which is similar to what we do, then, you know, our direwolves are direwolves. If you want to argue that our mammoths are going to be cold-adapted elephants with mammoth alleles, then say that.
It's actually the perfect example of, like, the well actually of the internet. It's,
yeah.
It's like, it's just people want to debate. It's the super cool thing that has never been possible happens. Yeah. And people are, well, actually,
yeah.
It's not quite as cool as you think. It's not exactly.
It's an amazing achievement from a scientist. I feel bad for the scientists, right? Because people are like, I've been asked, it's like, does this upset you? And I was like, I just did this thing in the LA Times, and they were writing an editorial that was quite negative. And I was like, they're like, are you frustrated with that? I was like, no. I was like, what story besides tariffs in the world 3 weeks later are you still talking about? I was like, what the people that hate Colossal the most about that are these like armchair scientists, right? That are not at the top of their field. Remember, we have people love to say, well, scientists disagree. I have 95 of the top scientific advisors and Nobel laureates in the world, right? I've got all the top ancient DNA experts are working with Colossal. And then I have 170 people with 140 of those being scientists that we pulled from the top universities. So
what do they disagree with? The little
they want the classification. Warriors. Classification.
The branding.
They want, you can't call them a direwolf. So I'm like, well, then call them whatever you want. And people hate when I say that, but I was like, If you want to continue,
call it Direwolf 2.0.
Yeah, or call it, how about this? Colossal Direwolf.
There you go.
And they're like, ah. And I was like, no, but that's fine. If you want to keep arguing the semantics on this, what you're doing is you're just driving more attention to my company.
Yeah.
So I couldn't be happier with people arguing the debate on what to call them.
I'm sorry. I'm going to go back to the methodology
because
I find it fascinating. So you take the Grey Wolf DNA, if you will, and we'll talk about like what are you actually taking? Like, is it a cell line? Do you synthesize it? But
Cell lines.
You take the cell lines.
Yeah. Okay. And what we found is that there's, because these are all non-model species, meaning they're not a mouse or a pig. These are species that really aren't that well studied, right? And so we find that different cell types and different species work better. With specifically the wolves, a lot of the cells were senescing and they just could, we didn't go through the process of making pluripotent stem cells, making basically reprogrammable cells back to their most nascent state. We actually discovered a new type. We didn't discover the cell. We discovered a new way to use a cell. Like the inner lining of like our veins, they kind of slough off these things called EPCs, endothelial progenitor cells, which are not fully differentiated because you can't clone from blood because there's no nucleus in red blood cells, but you can capture from blood these cells, which is awesome for cloning because they're highly efficient to clone. They're super easy to biobank. And from an animal welfare perspective, you just take a blood draw. And so you don't have to take like skin biopsies or liver tissue. You don't have to anesthetize the animal. And so for our direwolves, we actually use EPCs.
Yeah. So just to translate for people, or at least the way I think about it is there are, you know, in a gray wolf, there's how many cell types?
A lot.
Yeah. And, you know, they don't love to be messed with.
No.
Right? Like you start messing with the cells, they're not happy.
Yeah, they die.
They die. Yeah, exactly. And so there's only a certain... It depends on the animal, I assume, but like certain type of cell that you can even like tweak.
Yeah. And enough. So a lot of times it's, so getting to pluripotent stem cells is typically the best. Embryonic stem cells are great, the pluripotent stem cells are great because we can differentiate different tissue types. So we can test the edits before you even have to make the animal.
Yeah. That's where I was going to go with. So, you know, you're in the beginning, I assume you're kind of like guessing at the edits.
Yeah.
Like you think based on whatever, various studies and wolves, and you kind of know roughly this looks like it's the hair and this looks like it's the sun.
Yeah.
So before you ever kind of commit to the new embryo, if you will, you do edits in the gray wolf, whichever cell line you're using. And you can generate tissue from that cell line.
You can generate tissue from the cell line. So I'll give you the best example that I think people understand is, wait, did you see our woolly mouse?
Yeah.
So fan favorite, kid favorite. People, by the way, we got negative feedback from the scientific community when we launched the direwolf, when they're like, we thought they were only working in mice because we got some negative feedback when we launched the woolly mouse is like, they'll never get to a mammoth because these idiots are only working in mice and they're not very far. They're never going to. And they were frustrated at us because while we were taking this negative feedback, we had these direwolves that were already been born. And so, which are obviously not much harder project, but to that example, there's three ways that we can really test whether the edits that we make in a mammoth and an elephant will be a mammoth, right? You can grow one, which is risk.
Time.
22 months of gestation, quite a long time. That's option one. Option two is you can do some modeling and some like molecular test and is it exuding the right protein? Like you can do that test. I guess there's four. The third is you can grow organoids. This is tissue. So we actually have grown, we've created elephant pluripotent stem cells and we've differentiated them into organoids for hair. So we have like kind of creepy, super science-fied. So we actually have like hair growing in
like a petri dish.
Yeah, which is alive, but it's not a full animal. But then you can use mouse models, right? So what we've done is we didn't just take the mammoth genes and ram them into a mouse because there's about 200 million years of genetic divergence. We then looked at, okay, what are the specific variants in mice that are in the same gene? So we're looking at those same gene families in the sub pathways, and then let's make those edits. And then we did 8 edits in 7 genes. Once again, all using multiplex with 100% efficiency. We screened for off targets. So this is pretty amazing science. Like just that in itself, that delivery mechanism was incredible. So we did that. And then 21 days later, we got our woolly mice that had the color, the coat type, the hair length, the way the hair is growing different ways, the thickness. And so we were able to visibly see those phenotypes. So in longer gestational species, we can do that. Now, the good things about wolves and direwolves is they're dogs. So we've done a lot of genetics on dogs. So we went to Bridget von Holt, who's the number one wolf expert, specifically around red wolves. which is one of the closest living relatives to the dire wolves, which is critically endangered. The most endangered wolf on the planet is the red wolf here in America. And then we went to the Broad Institute in Eleanor Carlson, and she's the number one canid expert, geneticist in canids. So then we could look at doing all of that comparative genomics so that we weren't making gene target effects that could have negative impact.
Yeah, to translate it, I think for people, you think you know what in the DNA you need to edit based on a variety of different like ways you can research it.
Right.
You're not 100% sure you're right.
Yeah.
And so you have to kind of make the edit and see what happens. There's only so much see what happens you can do before you actually grow one.
Yes.
So you're looking for proxies like skin and I assume hair color, like that.
So on the hair color, I'll give you an interesting one. And once again, this goes back to this whole stupid purist perspective, right? So we found out, so before we brought back the dire wolves, here's what the world knew about dire wolves. We knew roughly where they lived. We knew roughly when they went extinct. We knew they were roughly 20 to 25% bigger. Okay. And we knew that based on muscle, and they had a slightly larger skull. And then we knew based on the bone density, we think they were heavier.
What's the defining characteristic you think that gets normal people to believe it's a dire wolf?
I think it's size. And that did know dire wolf. It's size, muscle structure, and craniofacial, the bigger snout.
The snout.
Yeah, those are things that so that's what we knew right before this. Now, what we found out, and this is the good and annoying thing about science, 5 years ago, there was a paper about dire wolves, right? And a misconception. So the result of that paper was, where do they fall in the canid lineage? The results of that paper, not our paper, but that paper, which Beth Shapiro, our chief science officer, and many of our scientists were on that paper, came out to, we don't know. We don't have enough data. They had 0.15x of the genome. That means that they had less than a full read of the full genome. We have 13x reads. We have 500 times more data. We have two specimens out. So what's interesting about that, that was, you know, once again, the press cycles. Because of Game of Thrones, you know, people in the paper, it mentioned jackals because they were somewhere in the canid lineage. So the paper, there were stories that came out 5 years ago that said dire wolves weren't wolves, they were jackals. And then there's paleo artists that drew them to look like jackals, so they're red. So when we launched our thing, people were like, no, they're not wolves. They're closely related to jackals. By the way, the original paper doesn't even say that. But the paleo artists that we all see in our minds from that original paper, they were red. So what we also found out when we redid the resampling was, one, they are closer to wolves. So we put out a paper about that. We also found out they were white because there's no dire wolf DNA. There's no dire wolf hair laying around. So we didn't know that. So we found that. And going back to your gene question, here's what we found. The specific edit, the specific variant that causes white hair, white hair in canids, so in all dogs, the specific truncation in the variant, the specific one has been known that that at least our two dire wolves had with 60 million years of genetic divergence. So we know that they're white, but it does sometimes cause blindness and deafness in some wolf and dog breeds.
Yeah.
So this goes back to choice. So if we're rebuilding Dire Wolf 2.0 or rebuilding extinct species for today, like we think about, a purist perspective is just go stick that gene in and see what happens. Let's roll the dice, right?
Yeah.
From an animal welfare perspective, because we're certified by American Humane Society, the oldest humane organization in the world, that's a terrible idea, not just because of our certification, but because of like just true animal welfare. So what we then did is we worked with the Broad and other people and said, what is the same gene that causes the same coloration that we can put in that we know has no negative impacts?
So when you think, and I have a note here, it's like roughly 20 edits across 14 genes.
It was 20 edits across 14 genes.
Talk to me about the edits themselves. Yeah. Are these like individual base pair edits? Are you inserting like
a combination? So these were all SNPs. So these were all individual base pair individual base pair edits.
Sorry, are you doing this in gray wolves,
or doing this on the gray wolf? We call it the genetic donor.
So but then the validation process. You use the woolly mouse as an example of getting to the woolly mammoth.
Yeah.
What are you doing? This?
So we didn't do a woolly mouse type project for this because we know so much about dog genetics and wolf genetics, right? So
because
like,
we've been
like a
doing
pug
this
is
for
a
long
wolf,
time.
Right? Yeah. So it's just like it's
you make the edits. There's some validation that okay, we think these are gonna work. How do you handle like the actual editing itself?
Yep.
The tech. Do you do it in-house, out-of-house, and then there's this concept of like off-target?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Edits, right. These are all we can talk about, which is like so, you edit here, But also something happens over here and you didn't
unintended
realize.
Consequences are off target.
Yeah, yeah.
So these are awesome questions. So a lot of times, a lot of these editing tools essentially have like 15 to like 20% efficiency. And I think that's a good day in some of these cases, right? We're seeing 90%+ efficiency before we do monoclonal screening, meaning we screen all the cells, which we'll get to in a second. This answers your off-target effect. So what we do is we edit a lot of cells. One of the things that Colossal's done, I think that is novel, is we've really focused in two categories. DNA synthesis, so synthesizing big blocks that we can swap in safely, number one. And number two, multiplex editing. And I would argue, and I think that our investors would all argue that we're probably the number one company in the world in terms of multiplex editing, being able, and what that means in kind of layman's terms is instead of making one change, we're making a bunch of change. Now, where we're getting pretty interesting is we're clustering all of that. So we're building arrays to deliver not just multiplex editing of single nucleotides or knockouts, knock-ins, or even, and then these large cargo inserts. We're wrapping all that, and we've got a novel way of delivering a lot of edits at once. So we're now making over 50 edits at once right now, which is insane.
Yeah, the thing I think is sometimes hard to understand is like the more stuff you're trying to change in a single cell, the more chances it goes wrong.
Yeah, the more chances it goes wrong, causes breaks, causes unintended consequences like off-target effects. It's also the higher probability that the cell just, I mean, you're hitting the cell, right? Think about it, you're punching the cell.
And it's just like a CRISPR-driven swap.
It's a combination. So CRISPR is one from a knockout perspective. We're doing some of the work. We've got licenses to the base and prime editing from the Broad and from David Liu's lab. And so we're using a combination of all these tools, and then we're packaging all of it in different ways. And I think one of the things that's interesting about Colossal is our packaging and our delivery mechanisms are creating very high degrees of efficiency with how we're delivering.
So you get, maybe we can make some numbers up, but you got your cell line.
Yeah.
You make a bunch of edits. You hope, obviously, that the edits
work.
But then you screen after the edits.
You screen all the edits. And then one of the things that we do is we do full gene sequencing on the edited cells.
Yeah.
And then once we go through the somatic cell nucleotide transfer or cloning process, once we transfer the nucleus, we then resequence them all, which is a lot of
fertilized new cell.
Yeah.
Yeah. So step by step, basically, like you've got your cells, the gray wolf cells.
Yeah.
You've got a bunch of cool technology to go and edit them. That is actually very hard to do successfully at any scale because you just get like errors and issues along the way. Making 20 edits is not an easy thing to do without
There's only one other group that's ever done 20 edits that we've seen. Maybe there's someone that we haven't seen that's made 20 edits, and they were random knockouts.
Right.
So they weren't really like what we call precision editing, right? They weren't like, let's change this letter to this letter.
Yeah, or like take this whole thing out and swap a new piece of DNA in, which is like a big change.
Yeah.
You then have the like...
We've actually done over 100 kb swaps, which is crazy.
It's a very long
swap. Very long swap.
So it's got to be real precise of like, where do you start and where do you stop? And there's a bunch of like new technologies, let's call it, that allow you to do this. I mean, 10 years ago, impossible?
10 years ago, probably.
Probably impossible, So timing as well.
Yeah. And then, what's the big change? What do you think has allowed this?
I'd say there's the three things. One, AI and AI and access to compute is definitely, like, this would be impossible without that for us.
Part of it?
So all of the DNA synthesis work would be impossible. All of the comparative genomics work, some of the ancient DNA assembly, we've built some proprietary tools around it.
To like know what to change and the analysis there.
Yeah, we actually have a tool that's pretty cool. So we do a lot of interesting things. When you come from a software background, you try to think, we could solve everything with software, right?
But I
naively thought that. So everything, you know, it's like you have software hammers, everything looks like a software nail. So, but we have done some pretty cool stuff. Like, we have one thing that is not interesting to probably anyone else, but we fed in enough data over enough editing with different types of editing modalities that we can now effectively say, we're going to go make this change in this part of the genome, which is the best tool? And it actually relevance ranks the tools for us of what we should use, which have the highest likelihood of less off-target effects.
Yeah, those. I assume the answer would be the actual editing technology to like go into the cell, into the nucleus, and swap DNA in the spot that you want is reasonably new.
It's reasonably new, last 5 years.
Yeah.
So to do, maybe you could do like a single base pair swap.
But people are still doing that. I mean, people are claiming victory, which is great. I'm all about this. For a small knockout for just a single change. Like people are doing that all the time. Like, you know, like when the one of the negative feedbacks we got when we launched the Woolly Mouse project, which I would say is pretty objectively cute project. One of the feedbacks was like, well, people have made 8 changes in a mouse. And I was like, not at once.
Yeah. Individually.
Yeah. They've done it over 8 generations of mice. Right. And so we like these are the things that I believe that I don't know what the current upper limit is. I don't.
Of changes.
Yeah.
Before something just goes wrong.
We're coloring it so well that we're doing 50 plus edits right now. And so this goes back to your point of risk, right? Like one of the feedbacks that we got on the classification of direwolves was like, why didn't they make 1,000 changes? It's not going to make on a percentage basis of 3.5 billion base pairs. Guess what?
It may not matter.
It's not going to make it more direwolf, and it's not going to change the phenotypes anymore. Yeah. So the physical attributes, it's not going to make it look more like a direwolf, and it's not going to make it more direwolf from a percentage basis, right? Yeah. And all you're doing is doing more. You're just creating more risk for what? So that you can show the strength of genome engineering. Well, I can show that in a cell. I don't have to take the risk with a live animal.
So in the new cell, you take some of them, you sequence them, you make sure you didn't have off-target issues, yes. Meaning like, hey, we thought we were going to edit this thing.
And we did, but we also edited over here.
Yeah. Because DNA is complicated and it's not as simple as just like, you know, straight. It doesn't work that way. And so the notion of like off-target can be really bad.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? Either because like it just makes the cells not viable or...
And so that's where we spend a lot. We spend a lot of money and time on sequencing. We kind of like...
Good thing it's cheap now.
Yeah, but it's belts and suspenders, right? Like I think from a when you're doing not just cell work, but your goal is to have living healthy animals, like I think you have a responsibility to do that. And so people are like, "Oh, you raised so much money." It's like, "Well, one, we have to build a whole system. Two, we have to have the best people in the world. This technology is really expensive." Oh, and by the way, like we're adding in layers of safety protocols throughout the whole thing, cuz the last thing we want is some like, you know, stillborn animal or something because we made the wrong change and we didn't screen for it.
Yeah, you get a wolf with mental issues or behavioral issues or physical issues.
And that happens all the time. I won't say which one, but there is a zoo in the United States that recently had a stillborn giraffe that had multiple heads and multiple legs, and they weren't gene editing. That's just biology. Biology goes wrong, right? It's not perfect. And so I think we have a responsibility when we're taking in that forced evolution, right? That we need to actually overprotect to ensure that the things we're doing won't have negative
impact. By the way, and this is like probably a longer conversation for another day, but the whole like biology goes wrong thing, I think is like for normal people who aren't in science day to day, which was me, you know, as of like 3 years ago. Yeah. Now I get it a little bit better. Yeah. But you forget that like the ability for biology to go wrong is also what enables evolution in the first place. And so you need a little bit of like, nope, that's not good. Yeah. That's not good to catch the one that
advances the ball. For the
All right. Species. So you get, let's call it like the clean new DNA.
The cells you're super stoked about.
Yeah. Now you got to get them into essentially, I think of it as kind of like into like an egg, right? Yeah. If you will.
Yeah. It's a great way to look at it. So this is the same thing that we did. We as Humanity Not Colossal did with Dolly the sheep, right? Only they were using like archaic tools like jamming stuff together. We use a combination of robotics. We actually have a laser drill. We have a whole system that uses computer vision to drill into a hole into the outer shell so that we're not just hitting and like literally physically just jamming the...
You take the whole nucleus out and pop it in?
Yes. So we take the whole and we cut it. It's pretty interesting what
we can do. You explain that one in like kind of simple... I mean, dumb it down, but
So instead of like before they would have needles... in kind of blunt instruments that are just like jamming the nucleus to extract the DNA. We aren't doing that. So we actually cut a hole in the outer shell, the zona pellucida. We go in, we actually fabricate our own removal devices as well. Okay. Because there was nothing that could do exactly what we wanted to. And different species have different things. Like for example, we needed to build a one made out of quartz. It was the only way that we could do get past the zona pellucida in that we vibrated at an insanely high frequency to get into the zona pellucida for marsupial cells. And it sounds weird because you're like, oh, big giant elephant, little tiny marsupial, but their outer shell is insanely hard that we hit it as hard as we could with a laser and wouldn't open. Yeah, so it's crazy. So we do that. We take out that middle kind of brain. And then we put it into that of an egg cell where we kind of do the exact same process in reverse, suck it out and kind of make space for it. and then we drop it in. And then essentially you have an embryo, right? You have a precursor to an embryo, which is pretty awesome.
And you take that and implant it back into a gray wolf?
So you grow it in culture for a little bit, right? So once you get to a little bit further, you put it, we use domestic dogs. So we put them in domestic dogs.
So like it's the actual growth, what percentage of the, from like the actual embryo to growth is in the dog versus in the lab?
Oh, 99% in the dog.
In the dog.
Yeah.
So and in that
we
process.
We do weekly ultrasounds. It's pretty involved.
And why do a dog versus a wolf?
Well, wolves are endangered.
Yeah.
And so.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And so one of the things that Colossal, we do have a 17 person team we can talk about this, get weirder in a minute. We have a 17 person team working on artificial wombs. So long-term we'd love to grow everything exogenous, like through kind of ex utero development systems, but short term we're still using surrogates, right? And so we have to get good at for many reasons at interspecies somatic sonic co-transfer.
I didn't realize they were extinct or not extinct, endangered.
Yeah,
and so you've got to go to like a slightly adjacent species to grow. In that whole process, anything in there where you felt like this is just insanely complicated, we couldn't do it, and you figured it out? I assume there's tooling and tweaking.
Oh yeah, it's all like, I mean, delivering the number of edits is really hard. Getting culture conditions is really hard, and different projects have different issues. So for example, you do a different process with birds than you do mammals, because there's not a clear way to do somatic sonic, like do the cloning step in birds. So you have to use generational birds. So you actually, instead of editing like stem cells, or editing like EPCs with wolves, we're editing what's called primordial germ cells, the precursor to egg and sperm. But just to get the culture, like this is the media. It's like getting just the media conditions for those, what they're called PGCs, to grow outside of a bird body is insanely hard. It's only been done publicly in chickens. We're very close to having it done in pigeons because dodos were pigeons, and so. It's very, very hard just to get the media conditions correct on that stuff. So we have to innovate across the entire spectrum. But once again, when you do reprogramming, of cellular reprogramming, we know that there's a cocktail of transcription factors. We just have to get the right cocktail.
On the surrogate side, like how do you ensure cross-species compatibility of the
biggest? So we typically use the egg cell from that species, right? And so the further genetic distance you get, you could run into mitochondrial rejection issues of the, not of the parent, but of the host, of the host egg, right? And so we use
the dog in this case.
And so one of the things that we are working on in addition to artificial wombs is we are working on, and we're not there yet on artificial wombs, and we're not there on this other concept, but we are working on a universal egg concept of like, which I think has weird, interesting applications to mitochondrial health applications outside of Colossal, but how do you map and change basically have a universal egg that you could accept any type of nucleus in it, and you have a low probability of mitochondrial rejection.
Like the simplest form of an egg that you possibly can that will be transferable, the primitives of an egg.
So the wolf shows up.
Yeah.
And now I assume there's like a whole bunch of optimization work to make sure that, you know, the throughput and the yield, if you will, this whole process just like inches up and up.
Yeah,
you're probably wasting money
exactly.
In a lot of areas.
Yeah. I mean, the biggest thing now for us is, I'd say the two biggest areas for us from an innovation perspective that we are is delivering DNA, you know, how do we expand DNA synthesis and delivery? How do we also deliver multiplex edit, more and more edits at a high degree of efficiency? Because we can screen in the sequencing that allows us to know what we did wrong, right?
Why do you think you need more edits? I mean, the wolf looked pretty wolf-like.
I mean, it looks just like a direwolf.
Yeah.
So at least at this stage, morphological, I mean, they're 85 pounds right now and they're 6 months old, right? A typical wolf is like 75 to 100 pounds, right? So we're on the trajectory. The wolves grow for about 18 months. So we're on the trajectory for these to be 140, 150 pounds, which is roughly what direwolves were. So, everything, they're stockier. If you go look at a five-month-old, if you go to the internet and look at a five-month-old wolf pup and you look at ours, you're like, yeah, those don't look the same. You can, like ours look like the linebackers of the wolf world. It's just different species, right? So like on the thylacine or Tasmanian tiger, there's 70 million years of genetic divergence between the thylacine and the fat-tailed dunart, which is, it's a marsupial carnivorous mouse. So we're turning a marsupial mouse into a carnivorous wolf. Well, it's not a wolf, but it's a wolf shaped body.
So different species are going to require more edits, essentially.
Yeah, and so now the better we do at CompBio, we think that it's about 500 edits for craniofacial morphology. So we get that hypercarnivorism skull, like the thylacine is a super hyper, it was a super hyper carnivore. So it's about, we think it's about 500 edits, which we've made in one cell line, which is great. But some of the work on sizing and some of the patterning could be more. And so I think the thylacine project, it's hard to say, but it'll be thousands of edits.
Maybe a controversial question. So business model for a second, right? And obviously there'll be some pieces of this, which is like, we made a technology, it's cool.
And we spun it out.
We spin it out.
So we spun out three companies so far, a computational biology platform for human healthcare, a company called Breaking, which is a plastic degradation company. So we've accelerated, there's an enzyme, a microbe that makes this enzyme that literally breaks the chemical bonds of plastics. And so that's why we call it Breaking. And that's now, we've raised capital for both those businesses. We spun out another company we haven't announced yet that's valued at way over $100 million, which is great. So spin out technologies is
one. And each of those carry their own unique esoteric risks of like classic startups. Yeah, you've got the tech has to work. You've got to scale it. Someone has to pay for it.
Yeah. Someone's a run it. I don't run it.
So. Yeah. You find a CEO. So, yeah. But
I try to stay on the board as little as time as possible.
It's also a lot of work. Yeah. On the core business itself, do you view this as like people will actually buy the wolves as pets? I mean, they're not going to buy a woolly mammoth as a pet, I don't think.
So we got a tremendous amount of ask for everyone ranging from the requests on the woolly mouse were ranging from kids' pets, school pets, large household named, I don't want to out them, but museums want them. We've even had some museums reach out and say, well, mice don't live forever. Can we taxidermy them and put them in a display? And so we've gotten all kinds of those types of requests, right? We get the apparel requests. We get all these types of requests. I do think that there's lots of people that would love to buy our animals. That is not our business model. We're learning. If you ask us when we started, it's like non-existent. If you asked us 2 years ago, it was technology spin outs because we thought, hey, we can create enough option value that, you know, if you innovate across all these things and if we can deliver thousands of edits with zero off target effects, that company alone is worth $100 billion. Just that spin out.
Oh, your cash runs out, which is the challenge in that model, right? Because you got core cash and
colossal. You spin them out. Yeah.
You spin them out and then they need their own money.
They need their own money. We don't fund them, right? They go out.
Oh, I just mean without like a core revenue stream.
No, without core revenue stream. Yeah. So we are constantly raising money. So that was kind of model one. There's a huge economic driver, and you've probably heard about carbon credits, seen the carbon credit model, right?
Yeah. I would argue
crypto is more of a religion than a currency, but that's another argument.
I meant more like a lot of the carbon credit businesses them are fraudulent.
Yes. And so just like the early days of crypto, but what you've seen in that market, a couple things that you've seen in that market. One is you've seen this move to biodiversity credits because it's highly trackable versus like, so that's like saying there's now been studies that have been peer reviewed that says an elephant in Gabon has this annual ecosystem restoration and carbon impact, right? So you have people that aren't like, hey, like the fraud that you're talking about is like people are like, oh, like I'm going to go buy a bunch of forest and I'm going to keep all the animals alive. And they like wink at you. And then it's like, that's worth $1 trillion of carbon credits.
Or like,
right?
Here's this forest we didn't cut down. And either the forest never existed in the first place did cut it down and they just didn't tell you.
No, exactly. Right. It's been wrought with that. Yeah. But what you found is that if you look at like, you know, the Paris Agreement, 66% of people's agreements say that they have to move to nature-based solutions like rewilding, like some of these things. So if you look at things like rewilding elephants, if you look at kind of like the total economic value, and I'm not talking about anyone that's currently monetizing it, but from peer-reviewed papers shows that there is over $500 billion of value that's being added to the African, and they take into ecotourism, take all these things into it to protect, to essentially protect the forest elephant, which is critically endangered, right? And so what we're seeing, if you look at now PwC entering the game, you see TPG, raising $9 billion fund around this. You see, who else did it? Lloyd's of London's now certifying it. You're now seeing people saying, yeah, this market was nascent, lots of people running around. But here's the other thing. We know that ExxonMobil, and we know that, you know, in this extractive economy that we live in, we know that like Sumitomo Corporation, Mitsubishi, in strip mining, and where do you think lithium comes from? It doesn't like magically grow on trees, right? And so synthetic biology does not solve the house plant that makes lithium problem, right?
No.
And so
Nor is it likely, given
very, very likely. And so I think that those companies, whether it's social pressures, ESG, or government regulations like in the EU, they have to buy these offset credits, right? And so regardless of where the market was, there's now this maturation of the market. So for us, it's a perfect market timing because, you know, a lot of these pioneers got arrows in the back, which is great. Now you've got people that are actually coming in and having to certify and really understand it. So if we can go in and say, hey, we're going to return the thylacine back into Tasmania. We think the tropic cascading effects could be this. Let's go measure it. Let's bring in ecologists and conservationists. Let's then bring in Lloyd's. Let's certify it. And then let's also get government subsidies for...
This is the most progressive left business model I've ever heard. I love it.
Yeah, it's interesting. So we have both sides of the aisle. We're very...
It's not a domestic safari that's like really expensive to visit because I would go for that.
Everyone would go for that, right? And so...
Is that like an ethical consideration? I mean, a fancy zoo sounds awesome.
Yeah. I mean, look, I am not...
Five-star hotel. Yeah, the direwolf is at the...
Singita brings you...
But two things. Like, if you look at, like, on the ecotourism front, like, we talked to the Ministry of Tourism from Mauritius, where the Dodo was, and he's like, you're going to 5X our tourism, right? And I said, well, look, we would love for you to give us land that goes on our balance sheet. We would love to get the carbon and biodiversity credits that we can go sell, that we can get certain that we can, that isn't just like, hey, we promise you there's dodos there, wink, wink, but like, let's actually measure it. Let's have third-party verifications. Let's go sell it. And the other thing about the carbon and biodiversity market is based on the sexy factor, like the credits try to at a higher value, right? Because ExxonMobil wants to show that they're doing stuff with like, you know, alternative things like ethanol or algae, right? So they do trade at a higher premium. So if we can do all that, and then if we can say, oh, well, let's have a Four Seasons or a One and Only or an Aman be there and they do an eco lodge and we get a cut of that, then that's great, right? But also the local people get a cut of it and whatnot. And if it causes people in Mauritius to clean up the environment and remove the invasive species that led to the dodo's demise, then that's a win also for conservation. And so I think that you can find a way to put a value on nature. Don't you remember forever people were like, well, if we charge $100,000 to kill a lion, then we're putting a value. That was like the argument for like hunting lions. But regardless of how you feel about hunting, what they were right about is if an animal has some value and isn't just seen as some random animal that doesn't have value, someone will at least think about that, right? And so if we can do it in the opposite way, where you're not killing them, you're encouraging them to have an ecosystem function, I think that's pretty interesting. And to your zoo question, we're not against zoos. Like we think like people like the AZA and people that have great zoos like San Diego Zoo, they do a lot of stuff for conservation. They do really good stuff. We work and collaborate with some of them on different projects. You know, I think that bringing back extinct species just to put them in zoos seems like a weird optics.
You know, one business line of, you know, many.
Yeah.
I was going to go to maybe the...
But we think that we really do believe the restoration work, the biodiversity credits, where we think it's going to go is certified nature credits plus ecotourism. We think that's billions of dollars in ARR for us.
I mean, the tourism appeal is likely massive, right? Just given the...
And government subsidies.
Yeah. So human embryo editing.
We are not doing that.
I assume someone's brought it up.
Yeah, we do get that question. Oh, yeah, thanks.
So the reason I ask is, you know, theoretically, and tell me where I'm wrong, a lot of the underlying technology is to do like safe editing here. There's no reason why those technologies don't also apply to editing.
Well, it goes into germline editing, right? And there's a general more
on the germline side. Yes.
So I would say that Colossal does not work on anything that is human, Neanderthal, like precursor to human, or non-human primates. Just that there's just like we already get enough. You know, InQtel is an investor. We get a lot of conspiracy stuff already, right? We don't need more of that, right? So we're like, there's enough for us to do. We're not going to do some of that stuff. And then if there's applications to some of our technologies, whether it's artificial wombs or multiplex editing or computational biology, we'll spin those out. Other people can go through the FDA. They can do all that process. That's not our problem. Right? We can benefit from it, but that's not our problem. All of the technologies that we're developing, you know, the work that we're also looking at different delivery mechanisms. So outside of doing somatic cell nuclear transfer for which we're doing for the cloning, we did microinjection in embryo for the woolly mice. So we actually are editing. So we're delivering a way that also doesn't create chimeras. So you're actually getting all the delivery in. So it's really cool tech. And so all of that could be applied to embryo editing, we aren't doing that.
Wait, at what point, like the prioritization in all of this is probably an interesting thing. There's probably, I don't know how many novelty animals you can work on. I don't know if that's the right phrase. Just like continuing to do stuff that's sick and like would get me excited about it. But at some point, the dodo is like a little bit more or has some more practical considerations. Yeah. How do you think through the PR side versus the practicality side?
Our three like flagship projects, right? Mammoth, Thylacine, and Dodo all have Thylacine, Tasman, Tiger have applications to rewilding and to ecosystem restoration, right? So those are our three flagship projects. The highest staff projects are the ones we're working on the most. Number one. Number two is we pair each one of those with the critically endangered species, right? So with elephants, it's the mammoth, it's the pink pigeon with the dodo, and it's the northern quoll with the thylacine. And what's interesting is, like, you know, while we made three dire wolves, we also use that same EPC technology to clone four red wolves. There's only 15 red wolves left in the wild. It's the most endangered wolf in the world, and it's the only wolf that's only endemic to America.
And you think you can grow it in a dog?
I already have.
We have.
I have four.
There's four.
I have four red wolves. Yeah.
Is that public or?
Yeah, it's public. Yeah. Oh, just no one cared.
That's amazing.
Yeah. So.
I guess as you think about.
I shouldn't say that. No one cared in a relative number. Last, we did increase by 100,000-fold Google searches because I'm a data guy, so I look at all the data. And there were 7 billion media hits alone on red wolves. And there was, I think, 498 stories on just red wolves. So people cared, but, you know, there's 180 billion impressions on dire wolves. So relatively speaking, they didn't care as much. But then a week later, after we were on the Today Show, the Today Show just ran a special on red wolves. I don't think they would have done that without us. So we are building technologies to help conservation, right? Because another business line that we're finding, while we open source, I mean, the open source software is a great example, right? So you build a community, you build some tech, you build a community, you do it, people use it and whatnot. That's all great. But then you have the enterprise use cases, right? Where you've got someone like Microsoft or someone saying, hey, cool, this is cute. Our developers have used this technology. We love your technology. We don't want our developers to implement this for the Department of Defense. We need you guys invented the technology. You guys need to do it, right? So a lot of these open source communities will then have their private instincts. So while we open source all of our technologies for conservation, so like, you know, we're cloning red wolves, we're open sourcing all of that technology to make it more efficient, better for cloning. You know, I think we could productionize endangered species, which I think is an interesting concept. So how do we get species off the endangered species list because we're actually recovering them? Yeah. You know, we're not just saving their habitat, which is saving their habitat is critical. And it has to be done. So this isn't a replacement for this. This is an and. But then how do we also make more of them? But now governments are coming to us on a new business line where they're saying, hey, we're using all, we love some of the papers you put out. We love some of the concepts that our teams are working on. But this one government, for example, has a specific type of cat. And they were like, we need to get to 50 breedable females. Well, it's going to take them at their best rate based on the male to female ratio that their breeding cycle, the male to female that are born. It's going to take them 23 years to get there. It's going to cost about $300 million to get to their 50 genetically diverse females. We can do that because we can select for females. We can engineer in genetic diversity. We can do that in 3 years. And if they paid us $100 million, we'd still be making a fortune on that $100 million. So we could save them hundreds of millions of dollars, but more importantly, we could deliver a better product because we can engineer in more genetic diversity, and we can do it in 2 years.
Isn't preservation versus de-extinction like pretty separate in terms of like potential implications? Bringing back more red wolves, we know how they do in the wild. We know generally why they've decreased in number versus bringing back a woolly mammoth. I guess we don't. Do we know why they went extinct, and do we know the implications of bringing them back into the wild?
So it's a great question. We know a lot about rewilding because we know rewilding works because we've done it. It's a very systematic process that has indigenous people groups, private landowners, governments, local private landowners. So it's a very stage gated process. Like nobody just like in the Yellowstone wolf rewilding, right? No one just made a bunch of wolves and opened the gates and like crossed their fingers and rolled the die, right? Like no one did that. It's a very thoughtful stage gated process where you're in a managed care facility, you're in less managed care, you're in less managed care, and then eventually the wild, right? So it's a very measured process that I think's well documented, and it's very inclusive of the community to do that. So we do know, there's also been studies that show what the reintroduction of cold tolerant megafauna back into the Arctic looks like and how it revitalizes the ecosystem and kind of makes this mosaic landscape, which is actually really good for adding biodiversity, flora and fauna, as well as carbon sequestration. And so we know all that because there's been people that have done this and tested it, obviously not with mammoths, but other species. So I will say that, you know, from a conservation perspective, you know, we think that this is not a replacement for these technologies. This is just a new set of tools like biobanking, genetic engineering, engineering and genetic diversity, cloning. These should all just be new tools in the tool belt because it's forecasted that we're going to lose about 50% of all biodiversity between now and 2050. So we need new tools. Like we as the world are failing loss of biodiversity.
Why no non-human primates, monkeys essentially?
Yeah, I mean it's just one step closer, right? Like what we're gonna make giant Gigantopithecus? Like that's everyone. It seems to be a fan favorite. It's like a small King Kong. It's like I we're not gonna do that. So
the use case actually I'm curious about, and we can talk offline about it. Actually, is in animal testing for new therapeutics, for new drugs.
Yeah,
and.
Do you think AI will get to the point from a simulation design perspective that it can simulate all of that?
No, not even close. I would put that at 50 plus years.
I think it's one of the hardest things.
Because the data to know.
Yeah, on an animal.
What happens in a live, like human system, animal system is insane. There's
people,
no data.
And people, I'm 100%. With you, like fusion and so many other technologies are so much closer than that.
Yes.
Yeah, I think that is a very, very hard problem. So when I read these things about, oh, well, AI, and you're eventually going to be able to do simulation design, it's like, I think you're going to be able to do local simulation design, but I don't think you're going to be able to do it on a system model, a full system model.
I mean, one of my co-founders at Curie, because I was asking these same questions of like, you know, why can't we do it with computers as a computer?
Yeah.
And at one point he said to me, you know, a Petri dish is not a human.
Yeah.
And I think like just that
and a mouse model's not a human.
A mouse model's not a human, you know, a monkey is not a human.
We see all that in these therapeutics. So
yeah, and all the training data for a lot of these biology systems are on a Petri dish, which is a piece of plastic.
Yeah.
And so it's as close as we can get to a human, but it's not a live system. Yeah. It's like, you know, a cell and a piece of plastic. And
yeah,
it's not
totally
representative.
Agree. I totally agree.
So when you look at animal testing, if you think about, we would call them non-human primate testing, right? So it's essentially monkey testing. It is an absolutely required step for many new drugs.
I bet you could build a large language model for a large like animal model for non-human primates, though.
Well, I think the non-human primate thing that could be really interesting with the editing side of this is you want non-human primates that have human-like disease.
Yep.
Because that's going to give you a better data set.
Yeah.
And you know, the way you can give a non-human primate disease post-birth is limited.
Yep.
Versus if you could edit.
Yep.
And grow, you know, in an HP that is more likely to develop X, Y, and Z disease. And while that sounds, you know, rough from like an animal standpoint, it saves human lives.
Yeah.
Because now you can actually test and get more predictive data on a non-human primate.
You also don't have to have infinite cycles of that. It's a somewhat contained loop where it's like you do enough, you get enough training data that you feel confident, at least in this species of monkey, that you can
and maybe apply. Give a literal example, like some cancer or.
I mean, the one that I would. Now, we don't know what causes. From what we can tell, you cannot give a monkey, an NHP, Alzheimer's or dementia at this point.
Yeah.
At least no one's figured out how to do it. I mean, in theory, you could kind of like try and have them live forever and see if they naturally develop it, but you can't today.
You can't give it to it artificially. Can you monitor to the point of showing signs of?
They die too fast. And like that's an oversimplification, but basically they don't get it. They don't get it. And you can't give a mouse dementia.
Yeah.
And so when you're developing a new dementia drug or a new Alzheimer's drug, the only point in which you get any real data on whether this thing works is when you put it into a person.
Yeah.
And that could be $100 million just to get to that point, and the chances of it working are really low because there's no feedback loop, right? Like there's no ability.
It's also a long feedback loop, isn't it?
Well, you have to wait for the human.
Yeah.
So it's even longer than you think. Yeah. And so you test it in cell lines, you tested in mice, but like it's not really predictive.
We need the woolly mouse of.
Oh, this is going to sound insane, but like if you had a non-human primate edited so that it develops something like dementia or Alzheimer's, well, not great for the primate, great for the people, because now you can get feedback on your new potential drug faster and cheaper. And it's not like 5% faster or cheaper. It's like 90% faster and cheaper.
So or zero to never cheaper or faster.
I mean, the amount of things that we simply don't do or don't test, because getting a drug into a human for Alzheimer's and dementia, you know, essentially clinical trials, is so expensive and time consuming that you just,
what do you think about the whole notion that like Alzheimer is, you know, type 3 diabetes?
I mean, there's a lot of cool theories. I think the reality of biology, it's probably all of the above would be my guess, but like, what do I know? Yeah. I mean, this is the single most complicated organ in the history of the world, right? The human brain. We barely understand how it works. So like what drives this kind of stuff? It could be like 9 things all at once. Yeah. Wouldn't it be nice to be able to study it in a monkey? And that would accelerate, you know, research faster. So that's why I was asking about it. And it's not just Alzheimer's and dementia, but there are probably edits you could make. Now I'm speaking a little bit out of my ass, but like, I bet you there are edits you could make in a monkey that are predictive of disease.
I mean, you're seeing that with like PGT testing. Like, I just had a kid and we used Orchid Health to look at where they actually do full genome sequencing. And so outside of the specific you know, major things people screens for and specific things we were screening for. They also kind of give you this, and it's somewhat, I don't know if it's controversial. I think not everyone subscribes to it, but they give you a distributed kind of like bell curve of like, of what you could have predisposed, what your child could have the, or that embryo could have a predisposition to, including, you know, early onset Alzheimer's and others and things like diabetes and whatnot. So you're at least understanding, because to your point, we don't know all of the things, but at least we know that there are specific genes and specific mutations that create a higher likelihood within environmental factors.
Yeah, it's great. It's just, you know, to drug it.
Yeah.
Is an incredible.
I'm glad I don't have to make that decision, because we made this decision not to be in therapeutics, because I think those are really hard decisions, right? I think do I think that people should explore all ways to make human life better? If you've ever had anyone that has gone through dementia or Alzheimer's, you don't wish it on your worst enemies in the world. So you don't. And so if there are ways to achieve it, I think that's something that we as humanity should, you know, if we achieve longevity, escape velocity, but we don't solve that, well, then what's the point?
Logan just wants to base edit so his kids are Knicks fans.
Yeah, exactly.
No, is there a Knicks gene there somewhere?
He's already watched two games in 5 days of life, so he's moving along pretty well on Knicks fandom.
Yeah.
Playoff basketball. Best place to start.
I'm curious, like, you bump into religious zeal, you bump into regulatory considerations. Like, you're sort of in the petri dish, I guess, to, you know, use a cute term, of like society's third rails, it feels like, in so many different ways. Not to mention the PR storm that you guys get caught up in or benefit from, depending on the day, probably.
Before Direwolf, we were at 98% positive or neutral feedback.
Is that right? Crazy. Woolly Mouse, people love it.
Well, even before that, Mammoth, Osteodota,
Yeah.
And if you extract out, because we once again, data, if you extract out classification of direwolves, 98% positive also.
And what was it that was the direwolf that just sort of set off such a storm?
Can't call a direwolf.
It was really just that. It was that simple.
Argument, yeah. Silly argument.
I think the look, too. It's a vet, like, just the look of it gets national attention. Because it's folklore, right?
Yeah.
Like, they're in Game of Thrones-ish and others. I think it just causes people to be interested in it. Maybe, I guess, more so than the, what was it, the Red Wolf?
Was it a step function in PR, too, as well? Like,
we kind of got fucked, because we spent a lot of time with, what we do is hard and it's complicated, right? We spend a lot of time educating. Like, sometimes we get these articles where they're like, you know, the most annoying was we launched our foundation, right? So we make all these technologies available for conservation. We then open source all of that technology. We then also pick a species that we help. So for example, the number one killer of elephants in the world is a herpes virus, EHV. 20% of elephants. More than poaching, human elephant conflict combined. It's terrible. We have actually worked with Baylor College of Medicine, some of these AZA accredited zoos, to actually get they're in trials in elephants that's conferring resistance using an mRNA approach that we helped design.
You're vaccinating the elephants.
Yeah. And so, but check this out.
It's great.
If Colossal does nothing else, and we just saved, we'll save more, if that works, which it is, against the number one strain of EHV. I think there's five strains, but this is the one that takes like 75% of, it kills baby elephants too, so it's like fucking awful. That alone will save more elephants than all elephant conservation combined, right? And so we have to deal with, so even with all of that, right? You know, most people, like, there's still articles out there that, like, we then launched the foundation. We raised $50 million separately for the foundation just to fund other people to use our tech, because maybe you don't have the money that you want to use our tech, but you don't have labs or whatnot. So we'll fund you to do it if it's helping a species, or if you're developing new tech, as long as it's open source. So we're doing all that, right? And then, we launched that in London, and CNN was one of our launch partners. Like, then we launched the woolly mouse in one of the lines in the same article by the same journalist is like, they should do stuff for conservation. I was like, but you know we do stuff for conservation because we launched our foundation with you.
Yeah.
And so there's always an education thing. And the problem with Colossal Times is it's highly nuanced, right? Like, everyone's busy. Every PR company or every like media company is looking for clickbait. And so it's like, you know, dire, like, there was an article that was like, George R. R. Martin hasn't finished the last book of his A Song and Ice series because of Colossal. That's literally the title. There was another title in Bloomberg, right? So the launch title with Bloomberg was Colossal Brought Back Direwolves, because we spent, you know, 20 hours with Bloomberg. They got deep in the science. They really understood it. And their result was, oh yeah, we're not going to argue classification. This is a direwolf. It's the closest approximate thing. We're going to call it direwolf. Same thing with Time. Same thing with New Yorker. Same thing with many others. But then what happens is then you get wave two, which is all the clickbaity stuff, which is like, oh,
we want to argue.
There was actually an article that was one of my favorite titles by someone else at Bloomberg later, that's like, the Colossals, direwolves, and tariffs have one thing in common. It's like, this is the weirdest. So you're starting to get stuff like,
what was that, by the way?
I don't read the articles. Yeah. Like, there's billions of articles.
What's a bigger risk for the business? Funding, and they're not mutually exclusive, I guess, but funding or PR?
I think neither. I really don't. I don't. I think there's a huge app. We've been very fortunate. We have a huge appetite for funding. You know, we're not announcing new funding at this time, but, you know, publicly to this date, we've raised $435 million. I think that's highly likely to change in the future.
Yeah. So you have more than enough interest on the funding side.
There's unlimited interest.
And do you don't worry then
and
about...
And the PR side isn't... The PR thing is really just about education, not persuasion, right? Because we take this attitude, like, some of our biggest critics in the world, like my chief science officer, Beth Shapiro, number one ancient DNA expert in the world, she was one of the most negative person when we started the company. And we just reached out to her. You know why? She's the number one in her field. So regardless of whether she likes us or not, we would be fools not to reach out to her. So we've had that attitude, right? We don't have an attitude. Are we ever going to fix the clickbaity stuff? No.
Yeah, but I guess the question I was more getting at is the clickbaity stuff can often lead to derivative consideration on the policy side that might be...
We work really closely. It's a great question. We work with both sides of the aisle. Like, you know, you said that we had the most left.
Well, I was joking about the carbon credits.
Yeah, yeah. But I'm saying is, like, we work with both sides. Like, one of the things that we found on the Hill is that loss, regardless of how people feel about climate change and some of these other things, loss of biodiversity is a bipartisan issue. Everyone agrees losing animals is bad. They may have different motivations behind it, but neither side seems to really want to lose animals, right? So, like, we have a great relationship with the left. We have a great relationship with the right. We the Department of Interior and Secretary Burgum of this administration acknowledged our work and, you know, thought this was one of the most innovative things that's ever happened, which is a really kind statement, and also said that the technologies that de-extinction technologies now need to be a tool in conservation. Now, that was weaponized in the press and said, oh, well, now we don't have to save species. He's like, that's not what he said.
Trump's pick for, you know, yeah.
I'll give you another business model. Maybe this works, maybe it doesn't. But, you know, while I agree a lot of groups are interested in, like, keeping animals around.
Yeah.
There's obviously a bunch of, like, environmental review for rare species that we find on some, like, giant development.
Yeah.
And we spend 3 years arguing about, like, whether we care about the species, and then the development doesn't happen, which harms people.
Yeah.
Right. It makes houses more expensive. Could you work with developers to say, look, you find some rare species that you need to protect, we'll just make more of them and move them elsewhere?
So that's the argument that I think was weaponized by, Washington Post wrote, by other people's standards, not mine, a moderately unfair thing, because something like that exact example was brought up in a cabinet meeting, right? And that was just a discussion, right? I view it as it's okay to have these conversations. And the response to that was, that means we don't need the Endangered Species Act. nobody's saying that we don't have any, like Colossal believes you need the Endangered Species Act, right? It's like, but at the same time, like there are certain times where you take like, there's been numerous cases where there's been a population of frogs. They put a road in. They're now two populations of frogs. And this population smaller, they are now classified as two different species because there's a geographic species definition. Yeah. There's one of your Baskin-Robbins 31. And so there's a difference. So what I think a better model is to that is we should, regardless of why we're losing species, we do need to protect habitats. And we know that current conservation works. It just doesn't work at the speed at which we're eradicating species. So I think we have to continue to protect land, right? Even at some
cost to humans.
So I think we have to do that. And I think we just have to balance that, right? And then at the same time, we also have to look at what are opportunities for us to also biobank species, because no matter how good we are at conserving land, there's going to be some trade-off to humans where land development's going to move forward, land development's not going to move forward. So we have to biobank everything because we know overfishing and all these other things are going to continue to eradicate some of our species. So I think that having... Like, we have insurance policies for everything, yet, you know, like, the government and military is, like, one of their number one things is, like, readiness. How ready are they for a conflict? It's, like, one of the core metrics that the military judges itself on. Why don't we have that for biodiversity? And so sometimes I'm a very big advocate for having, like, the seed vault, like, in Northern Europe for species. Like, we need BioVault, a nationalized BioVault program. But then people say, well, then you're just trying to build an insurance program so that we can do with everything species. And that's not what we're saying. I think this is an and conversation, not an or conversation.
I mean, you could make the argument that if this technology works at any scale.
But it's expensive.
Totally.
And it's time consuming.
So is endangered species.
Yeah.
You know, I think that argument of like.
But if you can productionize endangered species and you can put and you can conserve land and do, if you can take modern conservation and layer on the ability to
move
to
the
productionize,
species. Yeah.
Then that could be a win for everybody, right? And I think what people recently have said was, well, if you could productionize endangered species, then you don't need the land. It's like, that's not what we're saying. That's not, you know, if other people say that, that's not, I can't control the world of what they say or what they choose to interpret the technologies. It's kind of like for a while where everyone hated computer vision because people were in China were using computer vision to segregate populations based on specific profile. Like, yeah, that's bad, but that doesn't mean computer vision's bad or facial recognition's bad. That means it was bad. It was a bad application of that technology. And so I do think though, if we can get animals off the endangered species list because we have one conserved land, done existing, maybe it's the same land, maybe it's different lands, right? But if we can conserve that land and do modern conservation and then productionize and make 1,000 or 2,000 or however many you need red wolves that have engineered in genetic diversity so that they have a population that won't go through a bottleneck, that should be a win for everybody.
Yeah, then you don't need the actual Endangered Species Act in the long run, or you just need it in certain geographical areas.
But you still need to protect species because you're going to have areas, both foreign and domestic, where people don't care, right? I think like we all care, right? But it's like, and we all want to figure out the hard thing is always figuring out human progress and our balance.
Oh, to be clear, I don't care. Yeah. I get why people care. Yeah. I don't believe in the Endangered Species Act. I think nature takes species extinct and has been doing it for 4 billion years.
Nature does, but we have been accelerating it, right? And so I will say...
But so are, you know, like lions accelerated the, you know,
I would
some
say humans are on a different pace.
That's just how it works. Earth has survived, you know, we go up and we go down.
Forced extinction a little bit.
I get why people care. I don't.
What I'm saying is regardless of what you're... I think if both sides of the argument open the aperture and look at technological solutions, look at exist like what currently works. We know conserving land works. We do know that works.
Yeah,
100%.
Absolutely.
But we also know that sometimes conserving land can come at a cost. So where are the balances? And I think those are important questions. But what I have found, the only decisiveness I found on the biodiversity topic is that we have different opposing views on how to save them. But generally speaking, people are mostly in favor of figuring out how to save them. And what we're saying is we are not the solution. We're just one new tool. So throw our tool in this whole conversation and see how it happens.
Yeah, you guys with the right land could pull it off.
But it is still, I will tell you, and once again, I run the de-extinction company, right? I will tell you, it is way more expensive, at least today, to bring back a species than to just say, hey, let's keep it alive here. It is more expensive.
Yeah. From a regulatory standpoint, are there things that you've bumped up against that are just feel nonsensical. And if you could wave your magic wand or, you know, do something, it's like, gosh, this is just rooted in 1900s prohibition.
I think there's different things. Like we work very closely with all the organizations. Like we were very transparent about it. The intelligence community or community is an investor in the business. North Dakota is an investor in the business. We have other states that have expressed
North Dakota interest. Like pension.
Yeah. They're economic and commerce development fund. There's other vehicles within the United States government that's interested in supporting the efforts, right? We work close with Fish and Wildlife. So we're working with all these different things, right? I think that, you know, I do think that sometimes there are things that could be changed and accelerated. You know, one thing in particular is there was this moratorium for a long time on GMOs. Now, we aren't creating genetically modified organisms for consumption, even though we do get asked if people could eat our mammoths, which is weird. But I do think that we got that question quite often when we launched.
It's really kind of a great question. I mean, whether you want to do it or not, it's an interesting question.
Yeah. But so I understand the need from a USDA and an FDA perspective to look at the classifications of genetically modified organisms for consumption. But for example, so we aren't doing this, but let me give you an answer that goes straight to regulation. The FDA has historically taken the stance that if anything has a edit in it, it should be treated as a drug, right? Well, okay, well, mammoths aren't going to go through clinical trials. And the other thing is, like, there's a process. We're not in the cattle industry, but there are people that are in the cattle industry. And a lot of times they have a pretty unhumane model of dehorning cows, because when they put them, they're not like running around like Yellowstone National Park, right? When they put them in these large things, they have horns, they spear each other. That leads to infection, that leads to disease. That can create all kinds of bad stuff for downstream for human healthcare. That could kill off the cattle. It's really, really bad. So they dehorn them, right? Which is a pretty inhumane process if you really, really look at it. But in the whole, it's good for the herd, but it's not good for the individual animal. But there's actually some researchers that have identified making, I think it's either one or a couple edits that make it where they just don't grow horns, right? Way more humane for the cows or whatever. But I'm not in it, but from my conversations with people that are in that field, that hasn't gotten through because it's classified as a drug. Well, that's silly. Like we have been doing genetic modifications to animals and plants for years. We've just done it inefficiently, and we've been doing it the old fashioned way, like with
crossbreeding.
And so I would say we're just doing, to your forced evolution perspective, we're just doing it way more efficiently.
Can you get the cows that don't release methane?
You know, there was a study. We were. I don't know where this went. There was a study that happened in Australia, where they're trying, I don't know where this went, so I'm only giving you a half truth on this, but marsupials give different levels of milk because so much of the gestation happens outside. So they give you like high fat, then they give you like 2%, and then they give you like skim. So the marsupial body is incredible. So the moms produce these different tiers of milk, which is really cool. And so there was a study, I don't know if it went anywhere. We didn't work on it, but one of our Australian partners at the University of Melbourne told me about this, where they actually were trying to figure out how you engineer that into cows so that you could have like 2% milk cows.
Oh, the one I always think about is
I know you're talking about
cow farts.
Yeah, I know you're talking about
which everyone laughs at, but it's like a greater contributor to emissions than, you know, flying.
Climate change.
Yeah, because you need the cows, and you know, they fart methane.
Yeah,
essentially.
And there's a lot of cows.
There's a ton of super ones probably like that, but what about the religious element of like playing God and altering?
I think we have a pretty, once again, we try to engage with everyone, right? You know, so we go on the most conservative shows, we go on the most liberal shows. We try to be pretty bipartisan and pretty inclusive, right? We've got some of the strongest atheists behind us. We also have some of the strongest, you know, Christians and people from various religions, Jews.
Sure.
And so so for us, I think that, you know, we have a tack that, and this goes to your probably where you fall. It's like, we've been playing God for quite some time. Like we're eradicating forests, we're overfishing the ocean, we're polluting shit. We're like I take drugs. Is that a form of playing God? I lower my cholesterol with a shot twice a year or twice a month. So does that mean that I'm playing
God? We screen human embryos for disease already.
Yeah, I did that with my son. So it's like, so is that a form of playing God? I built a distributed risk matrix for embryo selection for our kid. And we chose him because he came out on top from a weighted average that I made. So based on apologetic risk scoring, right? So so I think we do that all the time, right? And it's like, you know, I view it as, you know, there's not enough money going into conservation. We open source all the time. I look at this as like a free research and development arm for conservation, right? Like we're doing all this stuff as industrial and human application and other things that we'll make a lot of money on. We do think we'll make money from an ARR perspective on rewilding and carbon credits and biodiversity credits at ecotourism. But separately, we're just giving all this stuff away from conservation. So anyone that's been in research and development knows it's a huge fucking R and a very small D, right? Very little goes actually into development. So we're burdening that cost and risk for the entire community. And so I think that, you know, we're definitely not going to do everything right, but I think that we're trying to do everything and work with critics that are at least informed to the point that we can get where, you know, people are excited about it. But the Plain Godwin doesn't come up as much as I think one would think. We get asked the question, do you get that question a lot? But for the most part, I think people realize that, you know, the intentionality behind what we're doing. Like if we weren't open sourcing stuff for conservation and we're just like, yeah, we're just making whatever we want, F off, then I could see how that
totally.
I
found that logic can be totally orthogonal to sentiment oftentimes.
Yes. And, yeah, that's a great point.
It's really cool. I mean, leaving the business model stuff aside for a second, just the underlying technologies to do this without like, you know, insane failure rates all up and down the stack are going to be used in a bunch of other settings as you guys, you know, bring the tech to market. So it's very cool.
And it's much harder to do with ancient DNA than existing. So we're making the tools like super hardened.
Yeah.
So
thanks for doing this.
Yeah. Thanks for having me. This is awesome.
Fun.